This is a session called The Spirit Sings, Exploring Creativity Through Song Making. I'm Linda Allen, and I want to tell you just a little bit first about who I am and what I do. I do want to make the point again, though, that I made at lunch, which is if you are a writer, this is not just for songwriters. This is to explore creativity in a lot of different realms. But the focus today, we'll have two sessions, and the focus today will be laying out a little bit of the background of the craft I do. What are some of the historical roots of songwriting, the role of the musician in our society, which is not that different from the poet, the song, the writer. So just to give us a little roots to grow from. And then we will be doing some writing towards the end of the session. So if you don't have paper, we have some extra here, and we'll have to explore things to write on. Go grab some Bibles from the other room or something to write on. I've been a songwriter for about 21 years, and I'm not only a songwriter, I'm a performing artist. I tour and travel, and I've put out 3 albums of my own songs so far, and I'm working on the 4th. I've also put together several collections of Northwest songs. That's been a particular interest of mine. This past year, I spent the year traveling for Washington's centennial year. I spent the year traveling, giving something called song sharing workshops, in which we talked about songwriting, as well as having people share their own material all around the state, and then also collected material for writing new songs. So at the end of the year, I had 19 new songs about Washington and its people and its history, and that's the album that I'm working on now to put out. So that's just briefly what I do. I started out back in the late 60s, as many of us did, when everybody at every gathering had a guitar, and everybody, it was sort of this amazing era when folk music was pop music. And I had not been raised in a tradition of folk music. Pop music had been more what I was raised in. And I discovered that folk music had some roots, had some history, had, for me, it was also a way in which I came to a lot of my politics. And it's amazing how many other people I've talked to who have said they came to their politics through folk music of that era, because a lot of it was political. It was making statements. It was far beyond the love songs and the kinds of expressions that I had heard up until that time. Suddenly it had some guts, it had some meat, and I was very excited. I graduated from college in 69, prepared to be a teacher. That didn't work out, and so in 69 I joined all the Flower Children and went to Berkeley and started my trade there, which was a good place to do that, singing in a lot of coffee houses, and again continuing to enmesh my politics, also my spirituality, because I had gone through school, a Lutheran school, and it was a lot of my activism was rooted in some tradition there too. So what I felt strongly was that I did not want to be an entertainer. You know, I mean, I wanted what I did to be entertaining. But what was important to me was that this was my tool of choice. I was still going to be a teacher. I was still going to be, well, I tried to be a preacher. I got turned down because I was a woman. You didn't apply to seminary back in 69. There weren't too many. But I decided this was the way I was going to use the gifts that I had. And so that has continued to be the focus of my work. Not that every song I write is political, not by any means. But it has continued to be a focus. Those of you who are around when I give my concert Saturday night will see that there is a theme and there is a direction. And without it, I wouldn't be doing what I do. I'd be in some other trade, I'm sure, because it is that important to me that what I say touches people's minds and hearts in some way, because I have been touched, because I have been changed so much by music. So that's the perspective that I come from. And I want to talk, I want to find I'll stop talking for a minute. I want to find out just a little bit about each of you, and if you could introduce yourselves as we go around the room, and after you do, if you could say, what is your mode of expression? Do you write? Do you write poetry, songs, stories, whatever? Or have you, or are you interested, you know, is that why are you here is part of the question. And also, what are you interested in learning from this session? We'll actually be doing two sessions. I'm hoping you can come to both, but what would you like to get out of it while you're here? Can we start?
Sure. My name is Brian. I'm a guitar player and vocalist, and I also do write, not music, but stories. And I'd like to learn to express myself vocally and how maybe melodies work. Mm-hmm. What's the direction in a melody, what you want to get out of a melody line, rhythms maybe, and...
Okay, we hopefully will get more into that in the second session than the first, but we will make room to explore that. And also I want to say too that I'm available outside of class and things we can't accomplish here. I'm real happy to work with people outside too. Okay.
Okay. My name is Solores. I come from my little town of Croy. I'm the school secretary. I've written a few poems over the years. And over the years, I'm not into too much, so. I'm talking for me. She says let her talk for herself. But she's really done more doodles. My mother wanted to come to this because she was really interested. And maybe someday I can do more, you know, writing and that. My only musical talent is I play the organ, which I just took up within the last 5 years, because no one has played the organ in our church, and it was another way to serve the Lord. So I just play very simple chords. I'm only into two sharps and one flat, and they tell me as soon as I learn more flats, it's going to be so easy. But right now, anyway, this is...
I am Ian Browning. From Tacoma, Washington. I've had poetry since I was 11 years old. I'm 85 now, so it's been a long time. I've been singing poetry contests for the first time was in Missouri. I got second prize on a poem about what a horse thinks when he sees so many automobiles on the road. Because of bad times, you can't buy gas or tires for your car during wartime. I got second prize on that. Kansas City, Missouri paper. And the last poem I sent in for a contest was about six. I got money right now in the world of poetry. That's in California, you know. I've been sending poems to them for 15 years in the contest. I have won 6 golden awards and 1 silver award. And I've been invited there to the August for a convention they're having. But I'm not going to go because it's going to cost too much. And I have written so many poems. I've had them published, I believe, in about 16 to 17 big books so far.
I think you could teach us a lot.
You could teach us.
Well, no. I don't think I could teach a lot because the Lord just puts the poetry in my heart and I just write it. I don't see any way of teaching it.
Thank you.
I love poetry, is why I'm here today to listen to you.
Thank you.
I'm Christine Borges, and I play keyboard instruments and recorder, and music lover all my life, folk music, especially the last 10 years, maybe. And I guess I'm more interested, mostly interested in the possible poetic form of songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Paul Blankenship. I'm a composer. I play piano and guitar. I'm here probably because I enjoy the talking to other musicians and the interacting about the process of creativity. That's okay.
One thing too is it's a very unique thing. Every person or every writer that I've talked to has their own style and what works for them. So it won't be me lecturing you and telling you how to do it. It will be very much a sharing of group knowledge and what works for you. So, okay.
I'm Jan Kirk, and I'm an artist and a writer and a singer now. And I've been classically trained mostly, but I just write songs. And it never has occurred to me to write my own, so I thought, well, I'd just come and see if I could get some tips. And I'm like, how do you start?
Great. Okay.
I'm Linda Eilers, and I'm a teacher. And I played, well, I was a music ed major, so I played a lot of different instruments, but I use the guitar a lot with my class. And a lot of things that I do are, sometimes I sing directions to them because they listen better than if I'm just speaking. So I make little ditties all the time that never get repeated again. So I just thought it might be interesting to them.
What a delightful use of music, you know, because that's so true, that music does have a way of cutting through and getting attention or getting a point across. It just, the impact of it, I think that's why I use it so much as a tool, because there's such a, it goes beyond the intellect and sort of hits the heart in a different way. Great. Yeah.
I'm Kay Brown. I'm a music teacher, and I'm a teacher first. Teaching is my first love, and music, I'm not a performer. I guess I have a lot of children with a lot of ability to write songs. I don't know that poetry and literature has always been a love to. I just love the arts, and I love music as part of it. That's just more personal than performing. And being able to help children to love that too is the most important thing. And I know that I have a lot of students who would be writers. And I'm here because I have friends who say you're wonderful.
Great.
I wanted to know more about you. And I've used some of your songs.
Great. Thank you.
Well, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to contribute much musically. I'm the world's greatest listener, though. And I have taught kindergarten, so I have worked with children on a very basic, you know, primary level. And I just have always loved music. I have, as a child, took piano and a little guitar and some cello, but never went anywhere with a career, and I dabbled in textiles mostly. So I'll be a good listener.
Great. Thanks. I know this lady. This is my mother.
I'm Jean Barkley, and this lady stole my thunder because I consider myself a listener. Linda has to have a listener, even though she's just practicing. That's my function.
That's not good. The total picture, though, because you're a writer. You've been...
I'm trying to write family history, mm-hmm. a long, drawn-out procedure.
Mm-hmm. I was just amazed at what you came up with. We were in a workshop yesterday, and we're asked to write, it was on family stories, which was a really fun workshop, and we're asked to write something, and I was straggling away, never really did come up with it. My mom came up with something. It's a beautiful little vignette in a few minutes. So, yeah. So give yourself some credit.
I'm Anita Hutley, and by trade I'm a nurse. I work in the schools with kids, secondary kids, and I also work with addicts and drug and alcohol. I'm here because I do write down some of my feelings and some of my things, and when I have a lot of things going on in me, it ends up on paper, and it's something that I just would like to know a little bit more about.
Okay.
As far as music, I play at the piano. I don't play the piano.
Okay. Great. I'm going to hand out a sheet that just some thoughts I've been collecting on songwriting, which will lead into the next part of the discussion. Sounds like a lot of you are ready to do some hands-on stuff, so we'll try and get to that fairly quickly. But just if you will just sort of humor me, I really like to get a little bit into why we as songwriters do what we do, you know, as much as anything, and what is our role in this culture and society.
We don't want to miss anything. So.
Pardon?
We don't want to miss anything.
Yeah.
Give it all.
If you'll take just a minute to read through this, give you some cues to consciousness as to where I come from and what I value about singers and songwriters. And also, you can insert, you know, for so many of these, also poets, writers. You know. But I want to talk just a minute about the role of the musician in our culture, in previous cultures. Why is it important what we do here? You know, why is this a value to the community, to our culture? Why has it always been? What role do we play? That's a question.
People can identify a lot of times with the thoughts and feelings that are in songs.
Mm-hmm.
Helps a lot of people feel like they're not alone in the things that they hear in song. Can identify with those feelings or thoughts that they have themselves.
Absolutely. I think that's a very, if I can expand on that just for a minute, I think that's a very important role. Because I think, well, you have a quote from Malvina, of how often the role of the artist is to reflect, and if we'll take it in a sort of a community-wide sense, perhaps some experience that the community has shared, perhaps a death or a tragedy, perhaps a mine disaster, or, you know, whatever that may have impacted the community, the songwriter, at best, has a way of taking that experience and then being a mirror to the community, reflecting back to them in such a way that they can then share that burden. And that's true in an individual sense as well. It's a way, certainly a lot of my songwriting comes from that place, and I'll write a song and think, oh, this is one of those, you know, exploring your belly button kind of songs. Nobody's gonna care about this, you know, this is a really personal experience. And then you get up the nerve to, you know, well, try it out, you know, in front of an audience and think, oh. And then, you know, you have three people come up to you after the concert and say, oh, you sang about my life, you know. That's just how it was. And a lot of times I don't know if I've touched on that kind of universal pulse until that happens, until I have a chance to put it out to the community or to the audience and have them respond and let me know, was this an authentic song? Was this something true to a number of people in the audience? And I'm often amazed at how, I guess I heard one writer say that sometimes the deeper you go inward, sometimes the more universal what comes out is. And that has often been my experience. But it's also been true that some of the very worst drivel I've ever read has been or heard has been from people exploring their inner psyches and just somehow never quite making it universal enough. And that's something I don't know that sometimes if we personally have that objectivity to know whether it is, and that's where we depend on our audience or on the people we check it out with, because I certainly am one who seldom writes a song and puts it out there without running it by a few of my favorite critics, you know, friends or people whose opinions I trust. And sometimes I'll pay attention to what they say, and sometimes I won't, but most often there's some, you know, they'll feed back to me what's authentic. Thanks. Yeah.
Well, I think music is so important because it's so all-inclusive. I've never had a child in school, no matter how troubled they were, that did not respond to music. And people who, you know, maybe don't read, they can hear the word, or the deaf community can respond in a way to music that it just includes everybody, and I think it's a wonderful way of passing down traditions of music, passing down history.
Mm-hmm. I could expand on that, but does someone else want to? In terms of passing down history, that's an important one.
I was thinking of it being history, but beyond that, it's a way to express things that aren't acceptable to express other ways. It just seems to, it's okay to say it in music where it wouldn't be otherwise, things that would make people angry or things that would make people feel things they didn't want to feel. Mm-hmm. If you said it, you wouldn't be allowed to say it, but if you sing it, it's somehow accepted.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you throw some humor in. Mm-hmm. That's true. That works very well. There used to be a tradition, someone told me about, that there was something, it was like a court jester in the olden days, who would sit beside the king and would write parodies. I mean, he was sort of like working for the people, and he would criticize the king through the songs, and the king couldn't do anything about it. This was like a sacred post in court, you know, to have the court critic who would do it through music. I thought that was, I mean, need more of those. I'd love to see one at Bush's elbow. You know, just, you know, I could think of some songwriters who could do that very well, too. But yes, the use of humor, venting that anger against some injustice of a group of people. If you think of the incredible history we have, particularly right here in the Northwest, of mining songs, or of union songs, of organ of the Wobbly songs, you know, Little Red Songbook of the Wobblies began in Washington State. We have a rich history, you know, of those kind of parodies. And still, they're being written, you know, for a while they were pop music, you know, some of these kind of parodies, and they haven't been for a while, but believe me, the writers are still out there writing and they're still getting sung. But yes, and in terms of history too, I wanted to add a little note to that. So often in our history books, certainly the history books that I grew up with, it tended to be very much a white male-oriented history. It was written from war to war. It was written more by what was important to men in our culture. And the stories that got left out, as most of you know now, certainly people of color, the stories of women, of women's lives, it wasn't considered important, so it wasn't put down. Besides, we have more of a circular way of counting history, and it revolves more around our family and relationships than war to war. That's not the way women would have chosen to count history. So we have a very lineal kind of history. Also, union people. I've been educated in the last few years that certainly the stories of the working people were not included accurately or fairly in our history books. So where is that preserved? It's preserved in diaries, in journals. It's preserved in the stories people tell and pass down. And so much of women's culture, so much of what I've learned about women's culture has been through the stories that get passed down through families, through the old photograph albums and diaries and journals. And this is the way, and through songs. When I first started becoming a singer and seeing this as my trade and my path, it was certainly, a lot of it had to do with women's songs. And women's songs broke that we're breaking out of the tradition of lullabies and love songs, which is what we thought all women wrote about. Mm-hmm. And I started learning this from this wonderful cultural tradition, particularly some British singers who were bringing from their traditions these songs of these strong women who were doing all kinds of outrageous things, you know, and were heroes and were strong and totally different role models. Now this came through the music. This didn't come from the history books. So yes, the preserving and also the norms and the values of the culture. Often I think of the singers, the Appalachian singers, and the women so much carried forth the tradition, and so many of those songs had a strong moral at the end to sort of keep people in line. And a lot of them would be about kings and queens, and they'd write about that. But if somebody got too far out of line, they always had their comeuppance at the end. You know, this was again part of their role of teaching, you know, of educating what the values are of the culture.
Even a lot of other music teachers and music people, and the one thing that has been a surprise to me, because my background is from a pastor's family, and so I always thought the church is separate from so much out there. Mm-hmm. I kind of wondered what the real world was like out there. And as I've talked to people who are involved in music, not so many of them, I'm surprised to find out that their love for music and their personal involvement with music first came from their worship background and their spiritual background. Mm-hmm. And they still feel that's the center of much of their expression in music. Mm-hmm. And although they're doing other things with music, but that's where their love of music really first came from.
So music is a spiritual expression, mm-hmm, as much as anything. Yeah, and so many of those hymns also were teaching tools. There are ways of learning about that particular faith. Yeah.
I think it just generally also adds another layer of meaning. You were talking about writing about events that happen in the community, and I know when I read a familiar story in another language, it's like, oh, wow, you know, all this extra stuff gets added in. Same is true if you put something that's happened, something important that's happened into music, that it's, you know, you feel and see things that maybe you didn't see before.
And it may not be historically accurate, you know. It may have the details all messed up, especially after generations of telling and retelling the tale. But what's important is it gives us a glimpse of how people felt about their lives and of what was happening to them. It's also very empowering, you know. Can you think of songs that were used to bring together the community, and still are. Hymns, again, there's another fine example of that, of celebrating our commonality. Look at songs like We Shall Overcome and the rich place it had in that the civil rights movement. It was a song that brought people together, that unified people. A lot of songs do that. Other things a songwriter does for a community?
Well, I put in a word, just a word for rhythm, because I think that we have, I mean, one of the things that makes music what it is this, is the pulse, the beat, no matter how subdued. And I think that's an expressive of something very physical, you know. We have rhythms and drives that we work with. And I think that's, I mean, you know, just telling a story in song, but with a rhythmic, you know, emphasizing rhythm is a way of, and you can even see culturally, you can define, say, African tribal styles by the rhythmic patterns. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are, you know, you ask a drummer to play two different Brazilian beats, you know, the difference between a baion and a, you know, whatever, you know, different types of beats, and the difference between two song forms might be very similar in terms of chord structure and melody, but the beat changes. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's something, I mean, if you just want to get into the musical side, but I think one of the things that that the musician does is it transforms that pulse of society into something with its rhythm. In the music, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That reminds me of something that I read, thinking about the music side of it, and the Encyclopedia Britannica, I was looking at the same, and it said that how often it reflects the culture in harmony ways, too, and also in the timbre of the sound. For example, in agrarian cultures, they usually, that people who work together very closely in very cooperative ways, usually sing good harmony. You know, their folk songs are, they just kind of automatically do it. They may be very simple, but they harmonize very well. And that's kind of the style of their music, is it's always a harmonious kind of sound. But then it kind of compared it to the Middle Eastern countries, where they have this wailing, to us really kind of awful sound. And the oppression of the women in those societies, is that it's like almost the voice of these oppressed women wailing and mourning and stuff coming out.
I mean, interesting just connection.
The song itself might be about totally something else, you know.
Yeah. This was an Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I was studying for a test, you know, yeah. So I was right off doing the encyclopedia, and I thought, wow.
This really is. And what's rich about this group, too, is that I get very caught up in words, which you'll find out. You know, I'm more of a word person. When I write words first, and the music is kind of secondary, and it's what carries the thought. But many of you may come from the perspective that what's essential may be the music, and the words come secondary. And that's very true of probably many jazz musicians, very true of many styles of music, but isn't true for what I do. So it's nice to have the balance and have people adding, you know,
it's
musical
like
notes too.
Someone was saying, you know, it's a way you can you're allowed to say in words things in a song that you might not be able to say straight. Well, the opposite is also true, that you can sometimes hear a song and there's no word that describes the beauty or the pathos, or you know, whatever the emotion is in that, and you try to explain it to someone, it's real nice, you know. I mean, this one works real quick to describe all those different nuances.
And when you talk about the beat, too, that's immediately what comes home to me is rock and roll, and how our kids love it, and how we loved it. And it wasn't because the words were all that profound. It's because you got to move to it, and it felt so good to move. And especially in those teenage years when you've got all that energy and you can just work it out. It's great. It's great for
very
that.
Very free, too.
Oh,
you know, yeah,
absolutely.
Well, yeah. When you look at the church, black church, you know, going between, say, the way we would sing a hymn and the black church sings a hymn is almost entirely rhythmic.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. And short thoughts that continually repeat often, you know, and that. Yeah.
I was wondering, to a songwriter, what does a song mean? Is it words set to a melody line with a beat? I mean, does a songwriter consider a song?
Words are the basic human rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
I
mean,
because poetry, you know, different. I probably would think you are a poet set to music.
Well, you know, I've heard an interesting difference described about the difference between a lyric writer and a poet. Mm-hmm. A poem is written to be read slowly, to be savored, to read, you know, many readings, mm-hmm. and you continue to find layers in that poem. For most songs, and there are exceptions, there are lyricists that I consider poets, but most of them not. In using this definition, because a lyric comes by once, and you have that time to put across an image, you know, a picture, and you need to get it that first time through. You're not going to go back and reread and you know, go over it. And so it's a different form. It also, for mine, I don't feel like mine stand up without the music. Mine really are very much intertwined with the music. And so in that, there is a difference too. There certainly are commonalities in that you still look for saying in the fewest amount of words trying to paint that picture. But it may take more words for a lyric than it might for a poem, because a poem is like a haiku, and I don't know about you, but when I read a haiku, I have to read it and read it and read it. Oh. And for a lyric, I need to get it, you know, when it first goes through. Does that help at all?
Yeah. Explain? Since you said the words were really the important part here, I wondered how many words you might sacrifice mm-hmm. for a melody, mm-hmm. you know, or if you just make a melody work with your words.
Well, I think maybe that's what I do. I mean, the words have, as you said, the words have their internal rhythm. And so when I'm writing, and it is, you know, for people who haven't done this before, you simply listen a lot to the rhythms that are already integral and internal in songs that you grew up with. Yeah. And then you try to match those kind of rhythms of the words. And you don't try, you know, you don't put too many words in, you don't put too few. You start getting a sense of there are just so many words that are going to fit comfortably in that melody mm-hmm. or in any given melody line. And maybe you'll put it to a familiar tune and then later experiment changing that tune. But a lot of beginning songwriters put it to familiar tunes and pattern it pretty closely from a familiar sing-song kind of song they learn. Do you have something, Paul?
Well, another side of that is that, you touched on it. But you can amplify the meaning of a word just musically. I mean, you can go back to Bach, who in chorales, there are beautiful chorales that talk about the death and resurrection of Jesus, where when, as they're tootling along, they're in nice major keys, and they go, get to the word death, and they hit a diminished chord that's very powerful, and then you move on, and then when you have the resurrection part, you know, then you burst out of this tense harmony into very beautiful, light harmony, and it's just a way of musically reflecting, and you couldn't say to Bach, you know, which words would you take away? I mean, it's not, there's certainly the words are the important thing, you know, but it's just an amplification of the idea.
Mm-hmm. Repeating the rhythm of the words, in the music.
There's sometimes differences too, and you know, I'm learning a lot as we talk, because as I said, I've been very much geared into folk music, and there the emphasis is you want to make this song singable, you want to make it repetitious, you want to make it like country music, you know, you want to have a good bridge or a good chorus that people are going to catch on to and repeat and repeat, you know, sometimes ad nauseum. But this is the idea that you're kind of looking for. It's going to mainstream folks, you know. And to listen to classical music often takes an amount of training and learning what to listen for and how to fully absorb and to take out of that music what you most want to get from it. And there may again be some real profound differences between what I'm talking about and bringing in this aspect of classical music, in which, yes, every phrase may be quite different. There may not be as many repeating parts. It isn't as necessary. Whole different wave. You know, yeah.
Can I make a quick point on her original question about what makes a song? Mm-hmm. It seems like a song is a three-dimensional story. And when I hear a song, if the melody and the words and the rhythm don't speak the same lingo, it's not really a song.
That's right. Mm.
And so the melody, like the words have to be what you feel, but the melody has to speak it also, and the rhythm has to speak that feeling into you.
So it's all important.
It is. And you know, there's a lot of songs out. We could put some words and put a melody line on it, but the melody line or the rhythm line has to talk what the song is trying to convey mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That's a good point.
That's, you know, that's true with a lot of hymns you sing, that the words do not fit the melody.
Notice that.
That's exactly right.
And it doesn't touch you.
No, hymns are probably the same.
Although maybe a lovely melody or a lovely text, they don't go together.
No, and that's why you hear so many wrong notes in, you know, in people. It's not singable either.
So I'm going to stop our discussion here because I want to get us started writing. We have 15 minutes left and we do have to start and end on time. So I'd like you all to have a piece of paper, and if you don't have one, there's some scrap here. And if you can figure out something to write on, again, you might want to take a minute.
There's some Bibles over there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, so if people need something to write on, there's that. And while you spread out your paper, I've got to run to the bathroom. I'm very pregnant, you may have noticed. Particularly mysterious about the process. I consider it a craft like any other craft. I think I've learned some skills because I've been doing it a long time, not because I'm particularly have magical gifts. You know, what I want you to know is it's something that's accessible to everyone. And I remember last time I was here talking to a man who just said, I don't have a creative bone in my body. And he was just absolutely convinced he could not write. And he couldn't even bring himself to try. And it was really sad that somewhere along the line he had been convinced that this was, you either had it or you didn't. And I don't believe that. So I want you to all believe that by the end of the course. But what we all do need are ways to release some of that creativity that's within us, because we all have such strong internal blocks against creating. And those walls are high and deep and built very much out of our left brain mode of thinking that wants everything to be logical and wants everything to follow, I don't know how to best describe it, but just to be able to define everything, to put labels on everything. There's a book that I have, there are two resources I'm going to, they're listed on your sheet, but I'll point out two of them particularly. Writing the Natural Way. And this is a really fine book for writers that help you release that creativity and gives a technique I'm going to show you in a minute called clustering. And that's sort of the heart of her book. And it's a technique, again, of accessing the right brain, which is more creative, which looks for whole patterns, which looks at a cloud and sees a profile of Lincoln rather than a gathering of water crystals or molecules or something, who looks at a piece of driftwood and sees a unicorn. You know, this is our right brain mode, and this is what we want to access to. And you've probably all heard about this concept, but this is one way we've heard of accessing it is to write with our left hand. this, sometimes I've combined this, but I don't think it's really necessary. I think it's a way, the clustering is a way to simply get beyond all those internal critics, which is also left brain, which says, ah, that's not what she wants, that's no good, you're a terrible writer, forget it. And it's cutting through that. Another wonderful book. This they have, by the way, at the bookstore. I noticed they had some copies there. This one they didn't, and I will suggest that they might want to start carrying it. It's called Writing Down the Bones. And it is also just a joy to read. And it is full of like 2 or 3 page meditations as much as anything on different aspects of writing. And the woman herself is a wonderful writer. And I just highly recommend this as, again, writing exercises and ways to begin and ways to structure your time. We'll talk more about this in the next session, some specific techniques, blocks, all of that. I really want to get you started. So, clustering. You start, and you don't need to write yet, but I'll just give you a sample of this. You start by putting in the middle of your paper a circle. And in that circle, you put an idea. Now, it could be a phrase or it could be a single word. And part of your work may be collecting, maybe before Thursday, collecting, you know, having a notebook with ideas, first lines, phrases, things that just come and go in and out of your head so that when you look at a blank piece of paper, you don't find yourself completely strapped for any possible ideas. It's nice to start collecting ideas and thoughts and phrases. But let's say, I'll give you one. Grandma, okay. Now, for the next 3 minutes, or 2 or 3 minutes, then we'll just brainstorm. Maybe we can even do this as a group. What is your immediate association for grandma? One word kind of things, or 2 or 3 at most.
Rocking chair.
Okay.
Perfume.
What does the first one say?
Rocking chair, oh. Perfume.
Hugs.
Okay. Did any of these lead to something else?
Cookies.
Cookies?
Cookies?
I
don't know.
Cookies. I think wisdom.
Flowery furniture.
Now maybe that can come off rocking chair. Is that an association there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Doilies.
Okay.
Glasses.
Can we go further with this one? Perfume, or does that come off? Doilies, glasses. Well, it could come off doilies, all right.
That's something potted plants with doilies.
I like that, all right.
I don't know what this comes out of, but holding the family together?
Maybe wisdom.
Tradition.
Tradition?
Tradition.
Let's see, family. Well, let's see that come off here. Family, bonding note. Okay.
Recipes.
Uh-huh.
Full presents.
Where would that come from?
Hugs,
maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Presents?
Stop. Dollar a year for every year you are old.
Okay, we've scattered around a little bit. The idea is when you're clustering, you start with a central idea, and then you just simply let the ideas flow and see where they lead you. Now, this one was going off on a track. No telling where we might have wound up there. If you get stuck and it seems like a dead end, you might want to go to one of these ideas or back to grandma and start in another direction. The idea is to keep your pen moving as much as possible. If you have to stop, then maybe you can stop and
kind of redraw arrows or something, or circle it, buy yourself a little time, but try and keep your hand moving, because it's one of the few ways to circumvent that internal critic that's going to keep telling you, stop, this isn't logical, this isn't going any place. And that's what you have to get to your first thoughts, to your primary thoughts. That's what you have to keep circumventing. So, 5 minutes. Okay, 5 minutes is enough. Get your paper out. Put a circle in the middle of it. And why don't you put the word, I'll give you one that often works in terms of, if you don't want it, if you have your own word, that's fine too. But I'll suggest afraid. Put that word in the middle of your circle, afraid. Now, what will happen is that you will find after 2 minutes maybe of clustering, maybe three, that you're going to find you've got an idea. And as soon as you do, either at the bottom of your paper or turn over your paper, and just start writing a vignette. Now, a vignette is like a tiny story. Spend no more than a half a page. It should kind of come full circle. It should start with your first sentence, which first sentence should come out of your clustering. You may end it with coming back to that. Now, you may not finish that, and we may look at those on Thursday or talk about those. But this is for your own use. Don't feel like this is something you have to prepare. Again, that internal critic, this has to be good enough to share with the class. It can be anything. Just please yourself. I won't say any more. Go.